So there's an interesting machlokas cited by the Gemara, also appears in Medrash, as to whether the mabul occurred, the catastrophe, the disaster of the mabul. Did it occur? Did it unfold in Eretz Yisrael? The simple reading, of course, of Parshas Noach suggests that the entire land was covered. All the mountains, the Torah describes Vayechusu Kol Ha'arim, all the mountains were covered. But Rabbi Yochanan adopts a very different opinion. And this machlokas emerges from a very unique halachic debate. The paraduma has to be processed very pedantically and very particularly with levels of tahara that sometimes supersede even the levels of tahara necessary for ordinary life in civilian regions, and sometimes tahara that supersedes even truma and sometimes hektish demands. In part because the paraduma is a process or an object which delivers tahara to people who have absorbed the ultimate tuma of a dead body. So something which is a bestower of tahara has to be absolutely immaculate and flawless. So Rish Lakish interprets actually a Mishnah. The Mishnah in the beginning of the 14th parak of Zvachim describes a paraduma which was processed chutz migita, outside of its natural region. The Gemara in Daf Kuf Yud Gimel cites Rish Lakish as interpreting this strange and vague phrase chutz migita. According to the Gemara in Zvachim, Rish Lakish believes that it's a paraduma which was processed outside of an area which was cleared of any impurities, or certainly dead bodies or bones. So there are certain areas that were cleared, that were zoned, that were prepped for paraduma processing. If the paraduma was processed outside of these zones, then it became disqualified. Rabbi Yochanan is a little bit less stringent, and even if the paraduma were processed in regular areas without apparent truma, it would be qualified or be suitable to continue the paraduma process. He interprets the Mishnah on the disqualification of chutz migita very differently. So Rish Lakish and Rabbi Yochanan disagree about a paraduma which was processed anywhere in Eretz Yisrael outside of an area that had been zoned and prepped for ultimate purity. The Gemara associates this machlokas with a different machlokas of theirs. Did the mabul occur in Eretz Yisrael? The simple reading of Parshas Noach suggests that the entire world was covered with water. A particular pasuk uses the word kol, vayichusu kol ha'arim ha'gvohim, vayichasu kol ha'arim ha'gvohim, excuse me, shetachas kol ha'shamayim. The entire landscape was covered with water, and all the mountains underneath the heavens were covered. So this certainly is suggestive that the mabul occurred even in Eretz Yisrael. This is indeed Rish Lakish's opinion. Since the mabul occurred in Eretz Yisrael, we have to assume that at least there may be sediments or some fossil remains of dead bodies. Even though the bones were cleared, they were drained, they were removed. And that's sufficient for day-to-day activity. That's sufficient for a person to confidently walk down the street carrying truma. But paraduma requires a surpassing level of tahara, and there need to be zones that are particularly cleaned and cleared for paraduma because of this specter of mabul residue. Rabbi Yochanan disagrees. Rabbi Yochanan feels that the mabul did not affect Eretz Yisrael, at least directly. Hence, we don't have to worry about fossil remains of mabul sediment, or mabul victims. And your regular area in Eretz Yisrael, at least b'diavad, is kasher to process the paraduma, and the Mishnah's disqualification refers to a very different scenario. So essentially, it's Rabbi Yochanan. Interestingly, it's Rabbi Yochanan. Rabbi Yochanan was well known for his love and praising and affection for Eretz Yisrael. And I'll mention some of the famous statements of Rabbi Yochanan in context of the Shir. Rabbi Yochanan believes the mabul did not affect Eretz Yisrael. Now, the Gemara pressures Rabbi Yochanan a bit later. This is on Daf Kuf Yud Gimel Amid Beis. And Rabbi Yochanan concedes that people who lived in Eretz Yisrael still died during the mabul, but they died based on the fumes emerging from neighboring locales. So imagine Eretz Yisrael being this one dry landscape amidst this larger periphery of flooded areas. And as we know, sadly, sometimes when floodwaters remain intact, it raises suddenly the hot waters and mineral-laden waters that had erupted from the abyss. So these waters produced a vapor that was very dangerous and killed all the residents of Eretz Yisrael. There's also a machlokas, the Ramban and the Beinu Bachaya, his Talmud, quote a Pirkei Rabbi Elazar, that even though the waters didn't descend upon Eretz Yisrael from the heavens, and this is based on the pasuk which Rabbi Yochanan quotes in Zevachim, quoted by the Gemara in Zevachim, Nafkuf Yud Gimel, it's a pasuk in Yecheskel. The exact language of the pasuk is in Yecheskel, Perachav Beis, Pasuk Chav Dalet, Ben Adam, Hashem tells Yecheskel, as he refers to him throughout Yecheskel as Ben Adam. Excuse me again. My apologies, I'm still struggling with a sinus infection, so my voice is a little challenged. Ben Adam, Emar La, At Eretz Lo Mitoharahi, Lo Gushma, Biyom Zam. You didn't receive the rainfall during the day of rage. That phrase, Lo Gushma, Biyom Zam, you didn't receive the heavenly catastrophic rainfall during the day of rage, indicates that at least the heavenly aspect of the Mabul, the direct deluge, didn't affect Eretz Yisrael. Lo gushma biyom zam. But it certainly invites the Ramban's suggested reading, reinforced by a Medrash in Pirkei Rabbi Elazar, that the waters didn't fall directly from the heavens upon Eretz Yisrael, but they may have overwhelmed or suffused Eretz Yisrael from neighboring lands. And not only did the vapors travel, maybe the waters traveled from modern-day Jordan, Lebanon, Syria, possibly Egypt. So, Rabbi Yochanan, the extent of his position isn't clear. The simple reading is there were no waters affecting Eretz Yisrael, though the residents died. Others suggest that the waters did infiltrate the land of Israel. Now, what's the meaning of Rabbi Yochanan's, not the meaning, but the consequence? How does this affect our view of Eretz Yisrael? The fact is it's just a historical point or something with some real consequence in terms of our relationship with Eretz Yisrael, our view of Eretz Yisrael. So I think there are 4 points. Number one, through the prism of a very famous question of the Maharsha. The Maharsha, a 16th century Polish rabbi, scholar, commentator, Rabbi Shmuel Eliezer Halevi Idels, Rosh Hashanah Shmuel Eliezer, Maharsha. Idels. Interesting, because his parish on Tosfos, and the parish on Tosfos is extremely, extremely intellectually taxing and calculating, and every time Tosfos takes a logical position, and in Tosfos the logical positions that are adopted can flip or invert in an instant. Tosfos is very serpentine and very circuitous and labyrinthine. And especially because it wasn't written by Tosfos themselves, it was written by students of the Tosfos, one of the most difficult perushim to read. And every time Tosfos takes a certain logical thrust, the Marshal calculates how that thrust can be reconciled with all the other previous texts, especially the Gemara. And it was included in the Vilna Shas. In today's yeshiva world, in most yeshivas, the Maharsha is not studied as avidly or as intensely as it once was, in part because the Brisker Derech of study has become so popular, and the Brisker Derech doesn't necessarily focus on the same micro-analytical issues of the Marsha. It's more of a macro-analysis of the logical categories reflected by the Gemara's halachic discussion, rather than a point-by-point arithmetic calculus of each logical statement and whether it can be reconciled with the entire system. The Brisker, let me say it differently, it's almost as if they're very different ways of thought. The Brisker system actually solicits duality because never assumes that there's one way to view halacha. These are all concepts delivered by a Kadosh Baruch Hu. By definition, they allow for multiple truths. So conversations at any level in a Gemara and a Tosfos are not meant to be synthesized, but are meant to be, in some ways, dichotomized into differences and different categories. So it's the whole pretext of the Marsha may, in some cases, run against Brisker analysis. But anyway, it's a very, very important parish, and even more important in some people's minds, because he wrote Chidushi Agados, he wrote Pirushim on the Agadic sections, which many Rishonim did not. A very, very famous member of the Polish rabbinate, he asks a question. if the mabul didn't afflict or affect Eretz Yisrael, then why does Hashem instruct Noach to build a teva? He should just have him sequestered in Eretz Yisrael. Very intriguing question. Let Noach become an immigrant in Israel. So the Marsha's answer is that there are other alternative purposes for building the teva. In part, citing Rashi al-Atara, the teva was a warning salvo to the people of Noach's generation, witnessing the 120-year construction ceremony or process without even a whimper of tshuva, just sealed their fate. But according to the opinion in the Gemara, that people in Israel died based on the fumes, and the Maharsha's question is rendered irrelevant. Noach wouldn't have survived the Mabul even in Eretz Yisrael. But I think there's a larger answer, or not a larger, but a different answer, is that Eretz Yisrael is not yet ready for a specific individual to be sequestered and rescued in its environment and through its boundaries. And this, of course, raises the larger question that for the first close to 2,000 years, there was a particular plan that Hashem had for this world. It was much more universal, in which Hashem's presence was to be readily available to humanity at large without, or with a very different need for Eretz Yisrael. This is a very subtle paradox, but an important one. On the one hand, Chazal interpret Bereishis Bara Elokim Bishvil Yisrael Shenikru Reishis, that Hashem created the world knowing that there would be a people who would accept uniquely his authority. On the other hand, Hashem only chooses Avram, the way the text describes it, based on repeated failures of humanity to live moral lives and to identify a monotheistic being. It has to be one people becomes a nation that can broadcast Hashem's presence. And the answer lies somewhere between the two, that Hashem wants there to be a more universal recognition, but there still has to be a people that is the vanguard and leads a more commanded life, but the gap between Jew and non-Jew is meant to be much more minimal. But unfortunately, the failure of history created a scenario of polarity where most of the world hasn't been able to fully embrace Hashem, although at certain levels theological monotheism has become very popular, and that's an embrace of Hashem's unity. It's only mitzvos and other aspects sometimes have disintegrated, and Hashem had to choose the Jewish people. And part of that selection occurs with the choice of Avram in Parshas Lech Lecha, and part of that selection process is the selection of a land to spearhead this entire procedure. Eretz Yisrael. So the notion that Noach would be rescued in Eretz Yisrael assumes that Eretz Yisrael is just this immune, impervious land to which no harm can come. It's not true. It's a protective shell once it becomes Eretz Yisrael, once Jews are selected and Eretz Yisrael is designated as the homeland. At that point, Eretz Yisrael can start to exert its unique supernatural protective elements. But the thought that Noach could just be spared without having any relationship with Eretz Yisrael, without being selected as a unique founding father of the Jewish people, certainly is something which is odd to imagine. There are two or three other consequences of the fact that the Mabul doesn't affect Eretz Yisrael. Prior to the Mabul, the world at large, humanity, and the actual landscape, the terrestrial plane, was endowed with supernatural potential, certainly supernatural and empowered when compared with our world. Imagine three different phases to our world. The phase of Gan Eden, in which obviously the world operated on very, very different terms. Certainly during the Sheshis Yimei Bereishis, Chazal tell us about the ore of Sheshis Yimei Bereishis that allowed a person to scope the entire planet, Mekseh Shemayim Berketseh Shemayim. And then when man fell, and really when he fell twice, when Adam fell and when Cain fell and when the land absorbed Hevel's murdered blood, so the world was plunged from its perfect state into a fallen state, not just human experience, but the world at large. Kotz v'dardar tatzmiach lach nava nati el aretz evashis, hostility between man and animal. And then throughout the ensuing generations, that disintegration and decay continued, not through any one particular act, but through an amalgam of moral failures. So when the Torah writes in Parshas Noach, Kishchis Kol Haaretz, and Chazal are looking for literal translations, the animal kingdom also committed sexual perversion. At some level, the relationship between man and nature was still so acute that human failure, at some level, began to affect the natural landscape, the world in which humans lived. And in some way, the Mabul was reflective of that complete collapse. It wasn't enough to exterminate human beings, but Hashem had to erase and almost re-layer the entire world. And the Psukim in Noach certainly are evocative. So, for example, right in the beginning of Noach, where Hashem informs Noach, Hinani mashchisam es haaretz. Hashem is not just looking to exterminate the criminals, but also to reconstitute the land. A little bit later, Hashem informs Noach, the Mabul is about to begin, Umachisi es kol hayikum. I will erase the entire reality, not just living organisms, but the entire landscape. Now, if the Mabul doesn't affect Eretz Yisrael, then Eretz Yisrael still retains that pre-Mabul supernatural potential that was eliminated with the Mabul. The post-Mabul world is a much more natural, rational, limited world than its two predecessors, the pre-Adam world, the pre-Chet world of Gan Eden, or Gan Eden-like experience, and the world between Gan Eden and the Mabul. So, when the Gemara describes some of the unique features and supernatural potential of Eretz Yisrael, it's because it's a vestige of a different world. Almost as if the land in Eretz Yisrael, its chemistry, its mineral composition, and certainly its spiritual substrate, is very different than any other nation, any other continent. I mentioned before how much Rabbi Yochanan loved Eretz Yisrael. Two of his statements probably reflect something of this view. The Gemara in Ksuvos, Kuf Yud Aleph Amid Beis, describes Rabbi Yochanan praising the fruits of Eretz Yisrael, amongst other Amorim who praise the fruit, but there are descriptions in that Gemara of the supernatural yield of the harvests and the crops in Eretz Yisrael, these gigantic, enormous fruits and large-scaled animals and goats. And Rabbi Yochanan heard about older people living in Bavel, and he was shocked because he interpreted the pasuk in Shema, Leman Yirbu Yimechem Bimei Venechem Al Ha'adam Arsher Hashem Uchechem Nasein Lechem. He assumed that long life can only be achieved in Eretz Yisrael, and he was shocked that people in Chutz La'aretz would reach that stage of extended life. And throughout Shas, Rabbi Yochanan, this is a Gemara in Brachos Daf Ches, throughout Shas, Rabbi Yochanan is very, very laudatory about Eretz Yisrael, and very deprecating towards non-Israeli residents. The phrase he would use to disparage someone, again, in those days they would disparage one another for failures to learn properly, but not in a way that today would be vitriolic or vituperative, but ways that were perfectly appropriate within people whose lives were committed exclusively to Torah study. He would call people a bavli if they didn't learn properly. The Gemara in Sanhedrin, the Tzedek Aleph, speaks of Rabbi Yochanan describing Sancheirev's meteoric rise to power. Why was Sancheirev privileged to rule the entire earth, to be such a dominant empire? And Rabbi Yochanan claims it's because he was so respectful of Eretz Yisrael. So even a non-Jew is rewarded for his relationship of reverence to Eretz Yisrael. Interestingly enough, the Gemara in Bava Kamma Kuf Yud Zayin describes an encounter between Rabbi Yochanan and one of his students, Rav Kahana, who had come from Bavel. It was a very intriguing episode, but towards the conclusion of the episode, Rav Kahana proves his Talmudic acumen, and he answers all of Rabbi Yochanan's questions, and interestingly enough, he changes Rabbi Yochanan's view of Bavel, at least of Talmid Chachamim in Bavel, to the point that Rabbi Yochanan sends his 11th son, Rabbi Masna, to Bavel to study Torah. And this is especially poignant given the fact that Rabbi Yochanan had lost 10 of his previous children, so this is his sole surviving child, Rabbi Masna, who then travels to Bavel to study Torah. So, the supernatural capability of Eretz Yisrael is something which is a vestige, something which survives the constitution of our land, of our planet, into a less powerful version during the Mabul. Number three, related to number two, if Eretz Yisrael wasn't reconstituted, then presumably there was also, metaphysically, spiritually, a moral capacity to Eretz Yisrael that wasn't adjusted and that wasn't affected during the Mabul. The Mabul recognizes that the immorality and the debauchery of the Dor HaMabul has affected the landscape, and Hashem has to reconstitute the land and reset the moral barometer of the entire world. But Eretz Yisrael is still operating on the earlier, presumably, higher levels of morality, because it isn't reconstituted or rebooted during the Mabul. So again, Rabbi Yochanan, the Gemara Nedarim, Daf Chaf Beis, quotes Rabbi Yochanan hearing from his student Ula about a murder that takes place, and he thinks that it happens in Eretz Yisrael, and he's shocked. How could there be a murder in Eretz Yisrael when the Torah describes anger and murder of Anasin L'chalev Ragaz about life in Chutz Laretz? And then Rabbi Yochanan hears that it occurs near the Nahar Pras, then he's placated, he's assuaged, he says, now I understand. Rabbi Yochanan couldn't believe that the immorality of murder would affect people living in Eretz Yisrael. The Gemara Kiddushin cites Rabbi Yochanan on Daf Mentes as saying that the two traits of cockiness and servility, Gasus Ruach v'Chanifa, people that are cocky and arrogant, and Chanufa, people that are unctuous, that are servile, that basically try to, a simpler word to translate? People just try to flatter. They're very falsely flattering of others to win their favor and to win their regard. So false flattery, Chanufa, where it says, Kas Chanifin, people who are false flatterers are one of the groups of people that can't encounter the Shechina because it's so forged and so manipulative. So he says that these two terrible corrosive traits, Yard El Abavo, you just couldn't imagine them existing in Eretz Yisrael. So on the one hand, that's why the expectations are so high in Eretz Yisrael, because we're operating in a different moral zone, and the consequences for moral failure in Eretz Yisrael are equally severe. So when, and not just for Jews, but when the Kusim are relocated by Sancheirav into the northern part of Eretz Yisrael, they're torn apart by lions, and they become Geri Arayos. They have to convert to be Jews, not out of any great theological discovery, but because they're afraid of the lions, and the lions, Chazal tell us, afflicted them because they worshipped Avodah Zarah, and they were idolaters outside of Eretz Yisrael, and they weren't attacked by lions. But somehow, idolatry in Eretz Yisrael is much more intolerable than idolatry in Chutz Laretz, because there's a moral sensitivity in Israel that reflects the pre-Mabul world prior to its being adjusted downward. And the final part of this position of Rabbi Yochanan is that Eretz Yisrael can't be decimated by natural disasters unless it's the people who drag it down. When the Jews enter Eretz Yisrael and they betray HaKadosh Baruch Hu, that is cause for the downfall of Eretz Yisrael. And it happened twice, and particularly the second round led not just to the expulsion of the inhabitants, but to the cursing of the land. And this is described in the Tochachot Svaretz Tiyash Shmama. And it was witnessed historically over the last 2,000 years when Israel was a parched, dry, infertile desert. My apologies to some who may have heard of this before. It's a very famous line, but it's certainly instructive and meaningful enough to be quoted even with the risk of repetition. Mark Twain visits Palestine in 1867. And in his diary, he describes the land as follows. We traverse some miles of desolate country, whose soil is rich enough, but is given wholly to weeds. A silent, mournful expanse. A degree of desolation is here that not even imagination can grace with pomp of life and action. We never saw a human being on the whole route. We pressed on toward the goal of our crusade, renowned Jerusalem. The further we went, the hotter the sun got, and the more rocky and bare the landscape became. There was hardly a tree or a shrub anywhere. Even the olive and the cactus, those fast friends of a worthless soil, had almost deserted the country. And here's his commentary. Palestine sits in sackcloth and ashes. Over it broods the spell of a curse that has withered its fields and fettered its energies. Palestine is desolate and unlovely. And why should it be otherwise? Can the curse of the deity beautify a land? Palestine is no more of this workday world. It is sacred to poetry and tradition. It is a dreamland. So it bore the curse, but it can only be cursed when the Jewish people impurify or adulterate it. But on its own, it's impervious to these types of natural disasters. Now, extrapolating that to our modern context, we now live in Israel. Now, some may view the fact that we live in a state that's hardly religious in the classic sense as a complete moral and religious breakdown, equivalent to the behavior of the Batei Mikdash, and therefore worthy or in some ways almost vulnerable to the types of catastrophes that certainly reflect or characterize the second Beis HaMikdash, the Korban. I don't share that view. And if you don't share that view and you see the return to Israel and the Jewish people in their land as redemptive activity, as a divinely inspired moment, even though we haven't attained the religious levels we seek, but it's certainly not something that can be described as a malfunction of Jewish and religious experience, then Eretz Yisrael can't be affected by floods, and Eretz Yisrael can't be affected by, it can be affected, but the wholesale ruination of this land is simply impossible. It's impossible then, and it's impossible now. And we're living in a very, very frightening period. We're witnessing nature-induced events across the globe, whether it's earthquakes, tsunamis, hurricanes, and we continue to daven to HaKadosh Baruch Hu that same large-scale decimation shouldn't afflict any human being, but certainly shouldn't afflict our people in our land. And there were times, obviously the great earthquakes, the earthquake particularly in the 19th century in Israel, and Israel is located on a fault line. And relatedly, we're facing the types of threats which at least in theory could obliterate an entire landscape. Nuclear war, atomic threats, particularly from Iran. No one's a prophet, and none of these threats should be dismissed or ignored. And certainly we daven to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and we also conduct whatever efforts are necessary at a human level to avert these disasters. But at some point, we have to ask ourselves, at the very least in our own minds and hearts, when Jews are living in Eretz Yisrael, not just when Eretz Yisrael is barren, waiting for Jews to enter, when Jews are living in Eretz Yisrael, can the land of Israel be affected by these types of events? If Amabel can't affect it, then can nuclear war affect it? And can natural disasters, the type of scale we've witnessed in other locations, can it affect it? And it's a very, very delicate question to ask on two fronts. First of all, because we don't, chas v'shalom, any level, celebrate in any way, not just that we're not celebrated, we feel such sympathy and identification with people who do suffer from these types of threats, and the emerging threats of nuclear war. We don't in any way scoff, and there's no triumphalism at our own safety. Second of all, because it's hard for us to know exactly where we stand in this historical trajectory and how exactly HaKadosh Baruch Hu regards his people and his land that have returned, and what the end of days, maybe certainly some of the apocalyptic prophecies, the script describing Yechezkel and Zechariah about wars in Harazesim and Gog and Magog and the ransacking of planets. This could certainly suggest that through history, Eretz Yisrael may have remained impervious to this type of despoilage, unless the Jews lived there. But towards the end of history, as a final end game, there could be very terrible events that occur with the great loss of life. But it's certainly something to think about when Parshas Noach unfolds.